Hello and welcome to a brand new year, and welcome to the February edition of the Astropod.
I'm Anna Quiter.
And I'm, as always, Quinton Goddard. Welcome to the show.
Nice to see you, Quincy.
It's great to see you, Anna. Good Christmas.
Yeah, it was great. How was yours?
It was fantastic, and it turns out Cambridge University have done something extraordinary. We finally managed to get a couple of astronauts into space.
Remarkable.
Yes, the only caveat is they were two teddy bears.
Well, only the US can put people in space.
Well, Anna, thanks for that. I'm not sure that's quite factually accurate. But here in the UK, we're desperately trying to catch up. And the Cambridge University Space Flight Society has sent up two teddy bears attached to a weather balloon. And this managed to get up to about 30 kilometres into space, or 100,000 feet. And it was launched from just near the IOA, from Churchill College in Cambridge, and landed about 50 miles away near Ipswich.
Yeah, Quincy, did you know that they were working with local school children, and the school children actually designed spacesuits for the teddy bears?
That's fascinating. I think NASA could really learn from this and make a change in their policy.
Well, they might be able to, because the spacesuits kept the teddy bears 25 degrees Celsius warmer than the outside temperature, so they actually did work. I think they'll have a bright future in astronomy.
Well, that is handy, Anna, because this is the International Year of Astronomy. Now, I'm no expert on who claims a year to be the International Year of whatever, but the International Year of Astronomy is sponsored by the United Nations and the International Astronomical Union. So it's good times, and I'm really looking forward to this year.
Sounds great, Quincy. So, are there any astronomical events happening in Cambridge?
There's always loads happening around Cambridge, Anna. And just to remind our listeners that every Wednesday going on right now, at 7:15 at the Institute of Astronomy here in Cambridge, they can come and attend the public observing evenings. Always tremendously popular and always has a different speaker each week.
And these are the last 2 months until next winter, so you should catch a lecture if you can. And also coming up is the Society for Popular Astronomy's annual meeting.
What are they discussing this year, Anna?
Well, Quincy, it turns out that the Sir Patrick Moore Lecture will be on the past, present, and future of lunar exploration. So now this talk is going to be given on Saturday, March 7th at the Institute of Astronomy, and it's free.
Do I have to book tickets for this event?
Well, you do have to book tickets for the special lecture, but there's a whole day of events starting at 9:30 a.m. that you can just come along to. So if you want some more information, you can email secretary@popastro.com.
Sounds great, although 9:30 a.m. is a little bit early for me. Now, Anna, I've got a question for you. Do you like space?
Yeah, I love it. We live in it.
Well, I love poetry, which is great news because on Thursday, the 5th of February, there's the event Dark Matter, the Poetry of Space, Space, Space. Now, this exciting event is happening right here at the Institute of Astronomy in Cambridge, in our own Sackler Lecture Theatre. Now, it starts at 7 p.m. promptly, but the doors open at 6:45 and admission is free.
Who's going to be reading the poetry?
Well, Anna, I'm very excited because the woman who discovered pulsars is coming here for this event. That's Dr. Jocelyn Bell Brunel. Now, she's going to be talking with Paul Modin, and they'll be in conversation with James Fenton and Maurice Riordan, and they'll be reading from the book Dark Matter, the Poetry of Space.
Quincy, I didn't know you were such a sensitive soul.
Yes, Anna, I am a very sensitive soul, and I do have many layers, much like a star just before it goes supernova.
Right. Moving on. So, Quincy, what's coming up in the show this month?
Well, it's an action-packed episode, as always, Anna. We've got some astronomy news, our amazing history segment, and a new and improved revamped Sky at Night section with Alex. And obviously the now legendary astronomy joke of the month. And I'm very excited this month, Anna, because I'll be interviewing Dr. Don Polarco from Queen's University in Belfast, all about his instrument called SuperWASP.
Wow, that sounds great. Well, let's get right to it. Here's Laura with the news.
Hi, I'm Laura Churcher, and welcome to this month's Astro News. Methane on Mars. Is the red planet really dead? Methane gas has been discovered by a team of NASA scientists in the atmosphere of Mars. The team carefully observed Mars for several years with NASA's Infrared Telescope Facility and the Keck Telescope, both at Mauna Kea, Hawaii. The team detected three features in the light from Mars that are due to absorption by methane gas. Michael Mummer of NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland explained why the discovery is important. Methane is quickly destroyed in the Martian atmosphere, so our discovery of substantial plumes of methane in the northern hemisphere of Mars in 2003 indicates some ongoing process is releasing the gas. The methane is likely being released either by geological activity on Mars, or possibly it may have a biological origin. On Earth, most of the methane in the atmosphere is produced by biological processes, but there are also large underground reservoirs produced by geological processes. The question is whether the methane on Mars has a similar origin. Is it currently being produced by microorganisms or from past seismic activity? Methane production could be going on deep under the planet's surface, where water and carbon dioxide could combine with the help of heat from molten rock. For this to happen, Mars has to be more geologically active than we previously thought. Alternatively, reservoirs of methane could also accumulate if it was produced by microbes deep under the permafrost of Mars's surface. Whatever the origin, the gas could be released periodically through cracks and fissures as the surface ice melts during Martian summer. One way of discriminating between the two possible origins is by measuring isotope ratios. Isotopes of an element have slightly different properties, and life prefers to use the lighter isotopes. If the methane on Mars was produced by living organisms, then the gas should show distinctive ratios for isotopes of hydrogen and carbon. However, we can't observe these small differences from Earth, and it will take future missions, like NASA's Mars Science Laboratory, scheduled for 2011, to discover the origin of the Martian methane. Milky Way piles on the pounds. Our galaxy, the Milky Way, is shaped like a frisbee, a flat disk containing spiral arms with a bulge in the centre. In the middle of that bulge sits a supermassive black hole, over 400 million times the mass of the Sun. It's often thought that the area around such a large black hole would be innately destructive due to its massive gravitational pull. Gas clouds are shredded when the black hole pulls more strongly on one side than the other, so you would not expect this environment to be a good place for stars to form. However, researchers from the Harvard-Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics and the Max Planck Institute have discovered newborn stars near the center of our galaxy. These stars are still hidden in the remains of the gas clouds from which they have formed, and so can only be seen at radio wavelengths. In order for the gas clouds to survive long enough to condense into stars in such a hostile environment, they need to be much denser than previously believed. Astronomers making high-precision measurements of the motion of stars in the Milky Way have found that the Sun is rotating about the centre, approximately 100,000 miles per hour faster than previously thought. The fact that it's moving faster means it's responding to a greater gravitational force. In other words, the galaxy is more massive than inferred earlier. At about 50% more massive, it's no longer the little sister to our nearest galactic neighbour Andromeda, but more of a twin. The increased mass also means that the Milky Way and Andromeda are pulling together 15% faster, so collide sooner, but still billions of years in the future. Finally, NASA has also released a stunning new image of the core of our galaxy. It's taken in infrared light, so reveals young massive stars and complex structures and filaments of hot ionized gas, features that are both hidden in the usual optical view by the dense dust clouds in the disk of the galaxy. Why not take a closer look for yourself? The images can be found at hubblesite.org, where you can also help choose Hubble's next target as part of the International Year of Astronomy. That's all for this month's Astro News. Tune in next month for more astronomy goodness.
Thank you for the news section, Laura. And with the Milky Way gaining all this weight, perhaps its New Year's resolution to be to get on a diet. But now I'm very excited. It's Anna with the history section.
Thanks, Quincy. As we've mentioned, 2009 has been designated the International Year of Astronomy. This is in honor of the 400th anniversary of Galileo's use of the first astronomical telescope. Here's a little information about the man behind the science. As a young man, he considered becoming a monk in the Camaldolese order, but his father convinced him to attend medical school at the University of Pisa. There he discovered his love of mathematics and natural philosophy and pursued advanced training in these fields. He first taught mathematics at the University of Pisa and then finished his career at the University of Padua. Galileo made numerous contributions to astronomy and physics, including the discovery of moons around Jupiter and the relationship between acceleration, distance, and time. One of Galileo's most famous astronomical works is entitled The Starry Messenger, and it was written in 1610. This is the first scientific work based on astronomical observations made using a telescope. Galileo discussed his observations of the lunar surface, star clusters, and Jupiter's moons. From his observations, he deduced that the moon's surface is mountainous, and that there are many more stars than can be seen by the naked eye, and that Jupiter is orbited by four smaller bodies. Today we have named these moons Io, Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto, and collectively they are called the Galilean moons of Jupiter. His scientific conclusions directly conflicted with geocentrism, which is the belief that the sun moves around the Earth. This was problematic because the Catholic Church's position was that geocentrism was contained in biblical scripture, and therefore it deemed competing theories to be heresy. Galileo published Dialogue Concerning the Two Chief World Systems in 1632, which is a book promoting heliocentrism, and heliocentrism is the belief that the sun is stationary and the earth moves around the sun. 1 year later, he was tried for heresy, and his sentence was life imprisonment, the banning of his heretical book, and a recanting of his heretical beliefs. Now on to Quincy with this month's interview.
Hello, and welcome to the interview section of this month's AstroPod. This month, I'm very pleased to introduce Dr. Don Polarco to the show. Welcome.
Hi.
So, Don, you're here to talk to us about SuperWASP, which is a telescope that you and your team have led. So just explain to us, what exactly is SuperWASP?
Well, it's not really a telescope to start with. It's more like a paparazzi lens with a digital camera behind it. Well, it's actually eight of them all together. And the thing about this is that the detectors, the digital cameras, are extremely high quality. They're science grade. And so they're able to detect incredibly faint objects.
This really is sort of cutting edge science that you've managed to develop.
Yeah, believe it or not, it is. Mainly because we're combining extremely wide field imaging. So we take pictures over big bits of the sky and we measure the brightnesses of stars that we see extremely accurately.
So you're measuring obviously a lot of stars each night. What are you actually looking for when you measure all these stars?
Yeah, we're looking for the telltale signs of a planet moving across the face of its star. Let me explain. As a planet goes around its star, occasionally its orbit will lead it to move in front of the star. The planet itself gives out no light of its own, and so the overall effect is to block out a bit of light from the star. So we see a little wink as a planet moves across the face of the star. That wink can take a couple of hours, and so we can recognise it.
So just how many of these events do you see per night? Or does it take sort of many nights observing just to find one of these exoplanets?
These are really difficult observations to make. Let me say that to start with. Let me give you an example. We're looking for variations that are about 1% in size, so they're tiny. But the atmosphere can vary by more than that. And so we're looking for a variable signal against whole variability from the atmosphere, and it makes it very difficult to find them. It's a difficult process.
So just how many confirmed detections do you guys have so far?
Okay, at the moment there are 22 SuperWASP planets, transiting planets. There are another two in the pipeline that will come very soon. I think the next largest survey has about 11.
Now, with obviously you're observing such a large area of the night sky, you must produce a tremendous amount of data. Just how do you analyse all of that?
Okay, let me give you some facts and figures to start with. Every minute, SuperWASP takes brightness measurements or images of something like 50,000 stars. So over the course of the night, we monitor millions of stars, or rather, we monitor the same stars 100 times. The consequence of this is that we take as much data as you can fit on a normal PC's disk. We take about 100 gigabytes a night. That data from La Palma is brought back over the networks to Queen's University, and we put it through sophisticated software to actually get the measurements of star brightness out. Then those catalogues are sent to our database, which is in Leicester University. Every night we measure something like 50 million brightnesses of stars. So just to put that into context, that's about the size of the UK telephone directory. And tomorrow night we'll do that again. And so our database grows by that much every night.
This is all an automated procedure, it must be, to deal with this amount of information per night.
Absolutely. There's something like 10,000 images taken per night. That's too many to look at. So in a way it's quite soulless, because all this data is being taken and it disappears into a software process and comes out the end as these magnitudes. And even then, you don't look at them. It's only when you when they end up in the database and you can look for this telltale variation in there.
So at the end of the day, you end up with a database that you can then sift through and find out the possible exoplanet candidates.
Absolutely. So there'll be, at the moment, just to give you an example, there are 1.5 billion data points in our database. Hidden amongst them are the telltale signs of this variation.
So it really is the archetypal sort of needle in the haystack type science we're doing here.
Absolutely. It's very difficult to do.
Excellent. So what kind of exoplanets, I mean, what are the sort of parameters of the exoplanets you're detecting with SuperWASP?
The size of the variation is basically dictated by the size of the planet. So the bigger the planet, the bigger the variation that we see. So if we want to look at small planets, we look for small variations, but those are more difficult to find, of course. So we're sensitive mostly to big planets like Jupiter that are in very short period orbits. And these orbits maybe are just a few days long, so it's quite different to objects in our solar system. But there's a lot of them out there, surprisingly enough. So from the SuperWASP observations, we can measure their size, and then we can do other observations to get their mass, and therefore we can measure their density. And that's just what you need. Those are just the values you need to be able to compare with theoretical models.
Is there a lot of sort of follow-up work you need to do or follow-up observations that you need to do to sort of pin down the values of these planets?
Well, absolutely. One thing we haven't discussed is how you sort out the candidates into planets. There's a lot of work. There are a lot of things that can mimic one of these variations. So you can have an eclipsing binary star, for instance. They can look quite similar given certain circumstances. And so we have to do a lot of filtering observations to get rid of those sort of objects.
And which telescopes are these carried out on, or is this a whole range of telescopes?
Well, they're not big telescopes. For none of this do we actually really need big telescopes. We tend to work with, once we have a SuperWASP candidate, we would do a better version of the light curve using something like the Liverpool 2-meter telescope. And then to measure the masses, we do spectroscopy. And we could do that with, there's a telescope in France at the OHP. We could use that 1.9-meter. Or we could use the Nordic Optical Telescope in La Palma.
Now, obviously, in the future, you know, everyone's talking about trying to find Earth-like planets. Is there any chance that SuperWASP in its current form might be able to find, you know, Earth-like planets transiting a distant star?
No. not directly. There are ways, though. For instance, you can imagine that if you had another planet, a low-mass planet in the system, then that would have a gravitational effect on the planet that is transiting. And so the overall effect of that is to change the time that the big planet moves across the star. And you could, if you observe enough of these transits, you could determine what kind of object was causing this change.
You might inadvertently detect another planet, one you actually initially measured.
Absolutely. These are not easy measurements to make, because you're looking at a very shallow transit effect, and you're trying to measure its time to within a few seconds, and that's a difficult thing to do. But with a telescope like the Liverpool telescope, we can do it.
Now, this is tough sort of high-end science. Do you have any plans to sort of upgrade SuperWASP, or any plans for the future?
Yeah, we've just gone through one upgrade with SuperWASP just a couple of months ago. You'll laugh when you hear this. one of the problems we have with our lenses is that they come off a Canon camera, and to change the focus, they need to get power. Even when they're in manual mode, they need power from the Canon camera. And of course, they're not mounted on a Canon camera body. They're mounted on one of these very special scientific cameras. So we've gone through a process of upgrading the focus on these so we can power them. But we've also done something whereby we actually heat the lenses, and that's to keep them at a constant temperature. Because one of the problems we've always faced with SuperWASP is that after dark, as everything starts to cool, then the focal length of these cameras change. And so the stars go from being in focus to going out of focus, or going from out of focus to going in focus. And that affects the measurements we make. So now we hope to have a much more stable system. And the overall effect of this is that we'll be able to detect much smaller planets. So that's one upgrade. And another upgrade we're looking at is not really another upgrade, it's a new system. We've learned a lot from SuperWASP, and from that we can put that together to make a new kind of transit survey, which again will be sensitive to much smaller objects.
So would that just be a much more sensitive array or a bigger viewing area as well?
Neither, really. It will probably be different kinds of arrays, different kinds of cameras that are sensitive to much smaller stars and therefore smaller planets.
And still looking for the same planet transition across the star?
Still looking for the transit, but for us to make this worthwhile, we have to be looking at things that are not big gas giant planets. We have to be looking at smaller objects than that.
Well, Don, this really is a sort of fantastic area of research, and we wish you the best of luck in the future, and we're really excited about all the results we've seen so far. Thanks very much for coming on the show. It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Quincy and Don. Next up is Alex with our new and improved Sky at Night.
Up in the sky this month, Venus is incredibly bright in the early evening at the moment, so take a look with binoculars and see what phases you can identify. Orion is also in a great position in the evening sky, along with the Pleiades. Both Orion's belt and the Pleiades contain some of the youngest stars in the universe, so take some time to observe these systems and consider that planets may be forming in their disks before your very eyes. Saturn is also rising in the east shortly after Venus sets. Also in the skies this month is the comet C2007N3, otherwise known as Lulin, which is likely to be the highlight comet of this season. Discovered in July 2007, it's on a very nearly parabolic orbit, implying that this is its first visit to the inner solar system. And so whilst this means that it's hard to predict what such a pristine comet will do in terms of its brightness behaviour, it will pass closest to the Earth on February the 24th, when it should be around magnitude 5 and easily visible with binoculars, or even with the naked eye in a dark, moonless sky. At this time, it will become visible in late evening and remain in view for the rest of the night. Shortly after this, it will reach its peak speed, travelling westwards at a rate of 5 degrees a day, fast enough to show motion even during a short telescopic observing session. One of its more unusual features is that it's travelling almost exactly along the ecliptic, but in the opposite direction. This means that as well as a tail, you should also be able to see an anti-tail, a spike pointing in almost the opposite direction from the main tail. This is because most comets have a very wide but thin dust tail, and so it's only when we're in the comet's orbital plane that we can see parts of this tail on either side of the comet's head. For most comets, this is very brief, but due to this comet being almost perfectly aligned with the ecliptic, an anti-tail should be visible for months. As one final note, it's worth mentioning that the comet's blue-green gas tail will always be pointing away from the Sun, as it is blown away at high speed by the solar wind. That's all from me for this month. Now back to Anna and Quinton.
Thanks for the information, Alex. Unfortunately, this month our producer Jane is out of the country, and so we've been allowed to get away with absolute murder on the show. Well, not literally, obviously. So I'm very excited to introduce this month's Astronomy Joke of the Month. Should be outrageous.
Hello, and welcome to this month's Astronomy Joke of the Month. As Jane is busy sunning herself in Madrid, this month my unwilling victim will be our sound engineer extraordinaire, Matt Bothwell. He doesn't usually speak. Hey, Bothwell.
Hey, Michelle.
So, I've got a joke for you, if you want to hear it.
I do.
Excellent. Drum roll, please. How do you get a baby astronaut to go to sleep?
I don't know, Michelle. How do you get a baby astronaut to go to sleep?
Put it in a cradle and rock it!
Well, thanks for that, Michelle. Outrageous or outrageously painful, you decide. Well, that's about all we have for you this month. We really hope you've enjoyed listening. Thanks.
If you have any questions or comments about our show, please email us at astropod@ast.cam.ac.uk, or you can visit our website at www.ast.cam.ac.uk/astropod. Thanks for listening.